God, the beneficent and merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. Peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. I greet you with our usual greeting on the Islam and Focus program, Assalamu Alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Today we have our 16th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing with the discussion of our topics of distribution and social justice in Islam, with special emphasis in today's program on voluntary charity. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me Dr. Jamal Badawi of Sheikh Mohammed University. Dr. Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
We always take a few minutes at the beginning of each episode to quickly summarize and highlight the main points that we touched on in the previous program. Could I ask you to do that for us quickly today?
Sure. We just continue our discussion of the basic things in economic system, consumption, production, and distribution. And on the question of distribution, he indicated that Islam looks at justice both in the distribution of commodities as well as distribution of income. In our discussion of distribution of income or achievement of social justice, we mentioned that there are four basic measures. One is zakah or institutionalized charity. Secondly, additional taxes. Thirdly, voluntary charity. And fourthly, the law of inheritance. Last time we dealt mainly with the first two. First, the question of zakah, or institutionalized charity. And in the case that it has certain features, one is that it is an act of worship, as well as an institution which is enforceable by law. And that the implication of zakah is not simply spiritual like preaching, but rather it has social, political, as well as Islamic implications, very important ones. We indicated how zakah differs from taxes, especially due to the fact that it has certain sources and has certain ways in which it has to be extended according to what appears in the Quran in verse 60 of chapter 9, that there are eight basic categories, you know, the poor, the needy, those who are employed to collect it, those whose hearts need to be reconciled, to free those in bondage, to help those in debt for the different reasons like disasters. To send in the way of God, as well as to help the stranded wayfarers. So it has definite budget, separate budget, if you will, than the rest of the finances of the state. And thirdly, that zakah is imposed on the net worth, which is usually about 2.5% as a common percentage, and that it is not a favor to be given to the poor or needy, but a right, according to one verse in the Quran, in chapter 51, verse 19, it shows that this is a right of the poor, not just sort of, you know, voluntary type. Secondly, we talked briefly about taxes, and we said that if the amount of institutionalized charity or zakah is not sufficient, then a just Islamic state can also impose additional taxes to meet the needs of the country, provided, of course, that there will be genuine need for that, that the distribution of the burden of tax should be kept in mind, and thirdly that there should be some process of consultation before a decision is taken.
Well, now perhaps we can move on to the discussion of the third means of achieving social justice, and that is through the institution of voluntary charity. Could you perhaps explain to us the basis for this, how it works?
Well, the most important thing about voluntary charity, or the basic difference, is not really a difference in spirit from the previous type, the first type, the institutionalized charity or zakah. Regular charity is not different really in its spirit at all, but the difference mainly is in the fact that in the case of institutionalized charity or zakah, it is mandatory, whereas in this case it is highly commendable act, but not necessarily something that you can really enforce by law.
Voluntary,
it's a voluntary type of thing, commendable, you're encouraged to do it. And the basic, the foundation of voluntary charity, like zakah also, is the feeling of compassion and sharing with other people. since you asked this concept of education, maybe I can just give you some quotations from the Quran and prophetic tradition that indicate the principle or the foundation of charity. For example, in the fifth chapter in the Quran, in verse 3, it calls on believers to cooperate in everything which is good and decent. And of course, there is nothing more important or more decent than or righteous than helping those who are in need, giving food to the hungry and shelter to the needy and so on. In the Quran, it's not only emphasis on encouraging people to pay charity, as we find, for example, in chapter 2, verse 361, that it gives them a beautiful way of the benefits and the appeal to charity. But we find in the Quran also, as well, emphasis on warning against those who have a sense of apathy towards the needy. We find that, for example, in chapter 74, verse 44, about those who do not provide food for those indigent or the poor. A threat equally is repeated in chapter 69, verse 34. And these are only examples of too many in the Quran. In the prophetic tradition, the hadith, there are quite a few examples of that. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, said, as narrated in Bukhari and Muslim and Ahmad and the Tirmidhi also, in all of these references, he says, a person who has no mercy on people would not receive the mercy of God. In another narrated in At-Tabarani and Al-Bayhaqi, he says, by the name of God, he is not a believer. He or she who sleeps full on full stomach while his neighbor is sleeping hungry beside him. In another saying narrated in Al-Hasim, he says that if a resident or a group of residents in a given locality or what might call today ward or something wake up in the morning and one of them is hungry, then God and his messengers are, you know, disassociating themselves from them. That is the innocence of their apathy. In one beautiful saying of the Prophet narrated in Bukhari and Ahmad, he says that if a person has food which is made for two people, like two portions for two people, let him get a third to share. If a person has food which is enough for three people, let him seek a fourth or fifth, which means that with God's blessing and with some kind of sharing, what might appear to be small amount of food could actually be used by relatively larger number of people. And the idea is not only limited just to food itself, but to help in general in any respect that one can afford to. For example, in Muslim, the Prophet said that if a person has an extra food, let him seek someone who has no food. If a person has an extra means of transportation, even like an extra horse or camel, or of course, somebody has an extra car, for example, that he doesn't need and one person is really in need, let him share it with others. Abu Sa'id al-Khudri, the one who narrated this hadith, said the Prophet kept saying all types of properties that one should really try to share with others until, as Abu Sa'id says, we started thinking that none of us would be entitled for anything extra. Mm-hmm. Of course, that doesn't mean this in Islam. You could still have something extra, but he said the emphasis of the Prophet made them get the impression as if we should always share whatever exceeds our needs. But in addition, of course, to this general encouragement of charity, there are special occasions also where charity is more particularly encouraged.
Mm-hmm. Well, could you give us perhaps some illustrations, some examples of such cases?
Well, first of all, there are some occasions even where zakat is not only voluntary, but even compulsory. For example, after the finishing of the fasting of the month of Ramadan, you know, there is a zakat called, or charity called zakat al-fitr, which is basically an equivalent to something like 5.5 pounds of basic grain, rice, barley, or flour, on behalf of each person in the household that you're responsible for, including yourself. It's more or less similar to what you might call today poll tax.
Mm-hmm.
And interesting enough, this kind of charity is required of all rich and poor even, provided that the person has food more than he needs for 24 hours, which even include the poor. Of course, some people may say, what's the point of a poor person who actually deserves to receive charity to pay? Yes, he may receive even more than he pays, but it has a nice meaning. It has also the special meaning of contributing something after the month of Ramadan, which is an act of worship. It has also the sense of dignity, that even if a person is a poor person, and he's always on the receiving side, to restore his dignity and feeling of sharing, at least once a year, he contributes a little bit, even though he gets more than he pays, but he feels at least that he's also contributing and sharing in this spirit of brotherhood. On the other hand, also, a poor could be given to another poor, so it's more or less exchanging of gift, and that provides for a nice feeling. But in addition, of course, to this part which is voluntary, let me focus on the voluntary, and the compulsory part. There are also voluntary occasions. An example of this would be, first, at the time of harvest, as the Quran indicates in chapter 6, verse 141, that when you collect the harvest, you should also pay or render its due on the day of harvest. That is, if some poor people are around, one should also give them something of the crop or whatever the person is collecting. In fact, during the lifetime of the Prophet, peace be upon him, a very nice practice used to be done, that when the dates ripe, they get a whole bunch of it and hang it on the door of the mosque, so that any person who feels the need can just go without even asking anyone and just eat whatever he needs. A second occasion is the occasion of marriage, because in Islam, as you know, marriage is very highly encouraged to protect morality in society. In chapter 24, for example, in verse 32, there is reference to encouraging people to be helped, actually, in marriage. Many Muslim Jews have concluded on the basis of the teachings of Islam that if a person is able to get married, that he might have a difficulty at the beginning, initial difficulty, financially, he's entitled to some help from the public service. And actually this was done, in reality, during the reign of Umar, the second caliph, after Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. A third example of occasion is the hospitality towards guests. That has been specified even in a prophetic tradition quoted in both Bukhari and Muslim, where the Prophet says that he or she who believes in Allah and the hereafter, he should be hospitable to his guests. For one day and one night, one should have an extra, like special, hospitalization, hospitality towards the guests. And for 3 days, a person would be expected to be a good host, but anything beyond that would be like voluntary or additional charity. A fourth example, the case of birth. In fact, one can say that under Islamic rule in the early days, there came into the world for the first time in history the first organized and systematic system of what you might call today family allowance. A fifth occasion, at the time of distribution of the estate of the deceased, as the Quran indicates in chapter 4, verse 8, that if some people are present who are relatives who do not inherit, not too close relatives, or orphans, or needy, then you should also give them something out of that state or money that's left over by the deceased. But in general, Islam does encourage mutual help and support. A reference to this blanket type of attitude is found in chapter 107 in the Quran, called Al-Ma'un, which requires some sort of neighborly help in any respect, not necessarily just food, but lending certain things that might be needed by another is regarded as part of charity also.
Mm-hmm. Well, now in your response to the last question, you touched on something that intrigued my curiosity, and that's related to the mention of the first family allowance system paid by the state. under Islamic rule. Could you perhaps explain to us when that was, when it was introduced, and something about how it operated? Is it like the universal family allowance system that we all are aware of in Canada now?
Well, let's compare it, for example, with a system that, like you said, is applied already in the 80s, 1980s, in an advanced country like Canada. Many people, of course, would think that this is highly developed, more sophisticated 20th century type of invention. It is not. In Canada, for example, as you know, there is a certain a small amount, but still amount of money that's paid to the head of the household, or sometimes to the mother, on behalf of each child that they have. And as you know, after the age of 18, if the child is still studying, or if the person is infirm, the allowance also increase after the age of 18, and that you think is a very sophisticated new system, really. As early as the 7th century in the Common Era, 7th century, so we're talking here about the caliphate or rule of Umar from the year 634 in the Common Era to 644, from such span of 10 years that he ruled. He instituted the system whereby for each child in the family, an allowance of 100 dirham, which was a kind of currency, was given. But it has a very nice feature also, that whenever the child grew up, the amount of the allowance was also increased, because in the realization of the course, increasing need of the child. Initially, the system called for paying this allowance to the child, or to the parents of the child, after his wound. But there was a very nice incident that led to even modification to make it applicable even from the time of birth. What happened is that one time a group of people were traveling, and they were camping, you know, like in a tent or something. And Umar, the ruler at that time, according to his custom, used to go around to find out if there's anybody in need or suffering. So he heard a baby crying, you know, in a tent. So he came from outside of the tent and said to his mother, "Look after your child." And then he went, and then again he heard the baby crying. He went back, "Mother, look after your baby." Again he heard him crying. So he came and said, you're really a bad mother. Why don't you look after your child?" Of course he didn't know who was speaking to her. He said, "Oh, but you know, the commander of believers, or the rulers, does not pay the family allowance except after the child is weaned. And I have a small baby, so I'm trying to force him, you know, to be weaned, and he doesn't. He still needs the mother's milk." And Umar started feeling very, very unhappy and very sorry for that. He said, "How many children did I kill now?" And then he said, "Don't worry, you know, you still receive the allowance, but don't hasten the child. Let him, if he needs the mother's milk, let him continue. Don't force him." And since that time, he decided that the family allowance, if you will, starts from this moment of birth. I hope that this shows that, you know, what we consider to be really a very innovative and just system has already been in existence under true Islamic rule as early as the 7th century. It's even slightly better even than the present system, because of the gradual nature that the family allowance per child used to be increased in the 7th century in proportion to the growth of the child. It's not just adjustment for cost of living, but it was adjustment also as the child grows, which takes care of the needs. In Canada, for example, it is increased only after the age of 18. So you make the same allowance for a baby as for the 17-year-old child.
Very interesting progressive development. Besides the charity on the occasion that we were just in discussing, are there provisions for charity under situations of emergency as well?
Yes, there are. One of the interesting things of the Prophet in praise of a group of people named Al-Ash'ariyin, relating to a tribe of a famous companion, Abu Musa Al-Ash'ari. And he mentioned about them, he said that those people, whenever they were, for example, in an expedition or traveling and their food runs short, what they used to do is to collect all the food they have from all, put it in one spot and then distributed equally among all of those who are traveling or in that expedition. That was narrated in both Bukhari and Muslim. Sometimes even when you have a more general type of emergency, like a famine, there was a famine actually during the reign of Umar, the second caliph, in the 7th century. What he did was to send messages to local rulers in different places that if you have some extra food or provision, please send it. So again, all of these supplies were collected in the place where the famine was, and he distributed not on the basis of anything, just on the basis of need, really, equally between the different families, depending on the number of people per family. In fact, one of the interesting sayings that Umar said, he said that during this famine, had it not been that the famine ended very quickly, I would have took all those who are hungry and distributed 100 persons per family. And then he gave a nice explanation. He says, because people would not die if they have a half full stomach.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But of course, the situation was improved, so there was no need for that. In fact, some Muslim Jews go to the point of saying that if a person is about to starve out of hunger, and nobody cares for him, he has the right to fight even those who are preventing him and endangering his life. That, for example, is mentioned by Ibn Hazm. Ibn Hazm was not the only one. In fact, during the reign of Umar, that was mentioned in Al-Kharaj, written by Abu Yusuf a long time ago. Those people who were traveling came back to complain to Umar. And they said, on the way, we got thirsty, and we were just about to die of thirst. So we passed by some people, and he said, won't you give us, please, some water? And they refused. You know what Umar's response was? He said, didn't you fight them? In other words, if you were really in danger of losing your life and they refused, maybe you had the right even to fight to survive. Of course, it doesn't mean that one should just go on fighting like this, but I'm sorry, in a dire emergency, and it threatens or warns those who prevent this, what might call emergency aid, that they could even be forced for it. Some verse base this kind of principle on a verse in the Quran in chapter 49, that's verse 9, that if two people fight, try somebody in need to correct the mistake that you did. One thing which is unique in Islam also, as documented in chapter 8 in the Quran, verse 41, is that in the case of war booty, the poor have a share. So it's not only those who are fighting take a share, but even the poor and needy are entitled to a share of that. In chapter 108 in the Quran, there is mention of the charity in the festival. The festival that comes during the pilgrimage period, Eid al-Adha, that it's better, or the ideal situation is to, kill a lamb or a ram, distribute one third for one's family, distribute one third to the poor, and one third by way of gift to a friend. It's not required, but it's highly commendable act for those who are not doing the pilgrimage. There are also a system of waqf or trust that Islam provided. A person can have a will and testament before he dies that certain amount would be invested and that the proceeds could be used for a continuous act of charity for certain purposes or the other. Some of this perhaps you can touch on when you deal with the inheritance, but there are several elements.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, before we move on to a discussion of the law of inheritance, the measures that we've been discussing so far, are these measures that are restricted solely for Muslims, or do they include non-Muslims as well?
All of them except for one include Muslims and non-Muslim citizens of the state as well. The only exception is the first measure, that is zakah, or institutionalized charity, which, as indicated earlier, is a special budget, or you might say designated fund, really, which comes from specific source and goes to specific expenditure. The reason being is that zakah, as you know, is a duty in Islam. It's not just a tax, a general tax in a secular sense that everybody pays, but is imposed only on Muslims, and it should go only to Muslims. But this does not mean that non-Muslims are not entitled for what you might call social security, because under Islamic systems,
yes,
there are additional sources of income. You ask, what do non-Muslims say? Well, if Muslims are paying zakah, which is both an obligation legally as well as an act of worship, you cannot ask the non-Muslim to pay the same, because it would be offensive to his religious sense, because he does not believe in that, and that is an act of worship, and he should not worship according to another religion if he doesn't believe in it. So it's actually out of consideration to that the non-Muslim citizens of the state pay something different, which might be called more or less like tax. It's called jizya,
mm-hmm.
which would be would make an equitable situation whereby he pays something as Muslims also pay. And out of these sources, as well as other sources, because in an Islamic state also you get certain income from land, in some cases called kharaj. You get other incomes, like I said earlier, for example, from the war booties or whatever, and this could be used actually to care for those who are in need. Maybe I should give you an example of the spirit of Islam in that respect. During the reign of Umar, he found an old Jew begging people for help. He asked him, what happened? He said, well, I became an old man now, I can't work, and I had to beg to live. And he got very angry. He took him to his home, he gave him something personally from his own food, and then he ordered the one who was in charge of the public treasury. He said, you should not collect the taxes from those people when they're young and able, and neglect them when they're old. And he said, for that person and the like, you should establish a kind of regular pay for them so that they can live in dignity. So the insecurity, right, is just like what the corporate has special security.
Mm.
So in terms of security and charity, there's no question about that. In addition, of course, one can say that all of the other measures that we discussed, the numerous measures, voluntary charity and neighborly health and all of that, are all also applicable to Muslims and non-Muslims.
Mm-hmm. Well, our time for today is gone. We want to thank you for watching. We invite you back next week when we'll continue with our 17th program in the series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be dealing with the topic of the law of inheritance in Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
I'm not going to stand in the way.